My name is Gary Strait, and this is Straight from the Road. People are all the time asking me if I'm related to George Strait. The answer is no. I don't look like him, act like him, walk like him, or talk like him. And I darn sure can't sing like him. But I have written a few country tunes, and that's what part of this story is about. That and a tale about a rock and rolling road trip from Key West, Florida to Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, and a 1953 Peterbilt motorhome. The Alaska Highway, more commonly known as the Alcan, is a fascinating stretch of highway in history that connects the 1,500 miles of wilderness between Dawson Creek, British Columbia, and Fairbanks, Alaska. Previous to World War II, the road ended at Dawson Creek. The explorers, trappers, gold miners, and settlers who wished to gain access to the Great Northwest had to make their own trail, or use trails made by Indians. They could also travel by boat to Skagway or Haines, then make their way over the mountains on foot or horseback in the summer, or with snowshoes and dog sleds in the winter. Otherwise, they would have had to stay home and watch TV until highways were built and motorhomes invented. Any way you look at it, the men who tried were consumed by the desire to discover new land, hunt rare game, or reap fortunes from the gold fields. Today, the expanse of land from Dawson Creek to Fairbanks can be traveled with relative ease by motor vehicle in a matter of days. I was surprised to see the number of motorhomes on the Alcan, but even with the luxury and convenience of a motorhome, this highway proves too much for some folks. Traveling the full length of the road requires a certain commitment, because once you are on the Alcan, you have little choice but to drive all the way to the other end. The alternatives are few and expensive. If the long and lonesome highway is more than you can deal with, you can always drive to Skagway and put your vehicle on a ferry down the Inside Passage. Or you can sell out and fly home. There are plenty of stories about people who have done both. On the other hand, some folks are so addicted to the drive that they travel the highway every year. Many people have a love-hate relationship with the Alcan. One popular bumper sticker proclaims, "I drove the Alcan. Yes, damn it. Both ways." There is a signpost in the center of downtown Dawson Creek designating that spot as mile zero of the Alaska Highway. Every location from that point north is marked with a sign stating its distance from Dawson Creek. I crouched down to take a picture of mile marker zero when I heard an angry voice yell behind me, "Bullshit!" I heard it again, stood up, and looked around. "That's bullshit!" It was early in the morning and the streets were empty, with the exception of an old man standing in the doorway of a business. "Excuse me," I said. "That sign! It's bullshit!" Then he mumbled something I couldn't understand, so I walked toward him. That's when I noticed an old woman crouched in the doorway. "So what's bullshit?" I asked. That sign is bullshit!" He spit the words at me and I got a whiff of his breath. He was obviously in the bag and I suspected the old woman was in there with him. Only then did I notice the old couple was huddled in the doorway of a bar room. "The real highway starts over there!" He pointed up the street toward a grain elevator. "I know, because I was here when they built the damn road!" He snarled while jabbing his finger into his own chest. "So why did they move it?" "Because they said more rich Americans would come here and take pictures and spend money, that's why. And us? What do we get? Nothing. Not a damn thing. Look at my wife. She has nothing." The man started ranting about the bar being closed. I suppose rich Americans had something to do with that also. I felt bad for the old man, but there wasn't much I could do to change his view of the world. On impulse, I reached in my pocket and offered the woman a handful of loonies, or Canadian dollars, and she took it. I returned to Zelda and loaded up to leave. When I drove back through town, I looked for the old couple because I was thinking about giving them some canned goods. I didn't see them, but I did notice the bar sign said open, and I suspected the money I'd given the old woman had already been invested in a shot of whiskey. That afternoon, I drove to Fort St. John, British Columbia, which was a milestone for me because that was as far north as I'd ever been. A few years earlier, I'd hauled a load of Caterpillar machinery parts to Fort St. John. That trip was in January, and the temperature sunk to 33 degrees below zero. Driving in extremely cold conditions can be hazardous. A trucker has to pay close attention to what he's doing, or he can find himself knee-deep in doo-doo. Diesel fuel can turn to jello, and moisture can collect in fuel lines, fuel filters, and air lines, then freeze solid. Then there you'll sit, stranded on the outskirts of nowhere. Add a little blowing and drifting snow to that, and you could be sitting there until the flowers bloom in spring. To my benefit, I had over 20 years of experience trucking in sub-zero temperatures all over the U.S. and Canada. However, Zelda had been born and raised in sunny Southern California and had no Arctic equipment whatsoever. There was no fuel tank heater, no fuel line heater, no fuel filter heater, and no air dryer. Since I had never been north of Fort St. John, I didn't know what to expect, and winter was just around the corner because there were already traces of snow on the mountain peaks and most of the trees were changing colors. I proceeded north, taking time to detour on a side road that was part of the original highway. There I found a long, curved, wooden trestle bridge that spanned a deep gorge. There was no traffic, and the road didn't appear to be well-traveled, so I parked Zelda in the curve, ran to the end of the bridge, and took some photos. It was just the sort of thing I'd raise hell about someone else doing. All the while, I was hoping a logging truck wouldn't come sailing around the curve and make roadkill out of Zelda. That night, I parked at a hunter's camp near Pink Mountain. It was dark when I arrived, so I nosed Zelda into the trees and went straight to bed. I woke up the next morning with that old familiar feeling of being watched. This time, the eyes felt predatory and wild, like those of a hungry animal. One minute the eyes were there, then they were gone. The beast was obviously stalking me. Zelda's tall vertical windows outlined the shape of the pine trees outside and served as an excellent observation point. I carefully rolled over in my sleeping bag and pulled the covers up to my eyes. My breath escaped into the chilly air and turned to vapor, which added to my camouflage, but I feared that the beast would pick up my scent. I lay there quietly for half an hour, watching, as the squirrel drug his nuts up and down the tree. Then I realized he wasn't that interested in me. He was either preparing for winter or conditioning himself for his honeymoon. Have I mentioned road fever yet? If you find driving the Alcan tedious, there are endless numbers of places to pull off and explore, but there ain't no Disneyland. Besides the wilderness hikes, there are many points of interest, most of them concerning the history of the highway. Being the antique truck junkie that I am, I couldn't pass up checking out the old trucks and machinery at the Heritage Museum in Fort Nelson. Among the collection of antique civilian and military vehicles was a Mercury pickup, a cockshut tractor, and a bus built on a Model A chassis with wooden park benches for seats. I could only imagine that after 1,000 miles of dirt road in that baby, you'd need a chiropractor, a proctologist, and a shrink. There were many samples of ingenuity. Among them was a homemade snowcat, a homemade sawmill, and a homemade motorcycle. The motorcycle had wheels that had been borrowed from a riding lawnmower, with a chainsaw for an engine, and the gas tank was made from the valve cover of a small block Chevy. I'd like to show up at Sturgis riding that thing. I suspected whoever built the contraption had been suffering from road fever. Inside the building, there was a makeshift theater set up in an alcove. I stepped behind a curtain made from surplus army blankets and sat down in an old wooden chair. Just over my shoulder was an antique 16mm movie projector. The crude arrangement reminded me of the theater my dad used to go to when he was a kid in Grand Lake, Colorado. The museum curator turned down the lights, flipped a switch, and a jittery black and white World War II newsreel came to life on the wall. The film was a documentary about the construction of the Alaska Highway. The original road was built by the Army Corps of Engineers as a safe means of transporting men and supplies to the military outpost in Alaska. It was mind-boggling to think that the 1,500-mile road had been hacked through the wilderness in less than a year, especially considering that most of the work was done during the winter. The film had scenes of corpsmen dozing out the road on Caterpillar tractors while others built bridges with hand-cut logs. There was priceless footage of Army vehicles speeding along the icy roads. Some of them failed to negotiate the slippery bridges, coming to rest in the icy riverbeds, with water up to their windshields. Most of those trucks remained in the icy graves until spring thaw. I'm certainly no war strategist, but I sometimes wonder how and why wars are fought. Why did they need a road to Alaska? Were they trying to prevent an invasion from the northwest? Did they actually think enemy troops could march through 1,500 miles of wilderness, then march another 1,000 miles across the Canadian prairie to the U.S. border, then launch a successful attack on what? North Dakota? I'm a firm believer in a strong defense, although I sometimes question how tax dollars are spent. But I also acknowledge that many of the places I'd visited from Key West to Montana had originally been strategic military outposts, and even the interstate highway system that I traveled on had actually been constructed for military purposes. Ironically, we all benefit from war in some perverse way. It's nice to imagine a world without conflict, but it's unrealistic. Wars have existed between cultures on this planet from the beginning, and they most likely will continue. And all the speeches from the goody-two-shoed do-gooders will do little to convince me otherwise. After all, selling the idea of utopia has long been the livelihood of preachers, poets, and politicians. Without the promise of utopia, they would all have to get regular jobs, just like the rest of us. Wars are the product of compulsive addictive control freaks who are willing to sacrifice everything in order to impose their beliefs on others. This will continue until all babies are raised by Ozzie and Harriet, or until preachers, poets, and politicians have their own personal therapist to manage their impulses. To bring this concept a little closer to home, consider someone you know that is a major control freak. They may be your spouse, your child, your boss, or if you were totally honest, you might be the biggest control freak of them all. Now imagine the world is full of control freaks. Which it is. Pretty scary, huh? Do you know how difficult it is to change a control freak? It's nearly impossible, even if the control freak is willing to change. I know, I've made the mistake of trying to change people, and I've struggled for years to change myself. It's a lifelong endeavor. Now imagine what it would take to change the world. Impossible? Perhaps. But as the old saying goes, if you want to change the world, start with the man in the mirror. These rantings and ravings might be the hallucinations of a madman. On the other hand, they might just be more symptoms of road fever. The last comment made by the narrator of the film struck me odd. He said that the Alaska Highway was not only a strategic asset, but also open passage to the vast resources of the Great Northwest. The road would have taken 42 dozen years and about $1 gazillion to build during peacetime. The only obstacle standing in the way of those resources was the lack of a measly little road. All some politician had to do was whisper safety or defense, and the cash gods would open the clouds, and taxpayer dollars would flow forth like manna from heaven. Amen. It's interesting how some people see the highway as a pathway to opportunity, while others see it as the road straight to hell. I exited the museum and headed out to Zelda. Several people were gathered around trying to get a glimpse inside, so I opened the door and invited them in. After I gave them a 25-cent tour for free, they all exited, with the exception of one man who was carrying a baby. He held up the boy, sniffed his diaper, then yelled to his wife, "Hey, this thing stinks!" "So, change it," she said, then walked away smiling. The young man let out an exaggerated sigh, then looked around Zelda and said, "Man, you got it made. I wish I had the guts to do something like this." "Like what?" I asked. "Build something like this and take off down the road." The young father was thumbing through my photo album and admiring pictures of some bathing beauties on the beach in Florida. "Where would you go?" I asked. "I don't know. Anywhere but here." "What do you do for a living?" "I drive a truck up and down this damn Alcan every day." I couldn't help but laugh. "Do you have any idea how many people dream about coming up here and driving this road?" "Yeah. Well, they can have it." "Where do you live?" "Alaska. I was up there in the military, met my wife there and decided to stay. Then this thing came along." He held up the baby for my inspection. "That thing?" I asked. The baby cooed, then stuck his finger in his father's mouth and said, "Daddy, I just wish I had the guts to do something with my life," he said. "I got some news for you, pal. What I'm doing ain't shit. What really takes guts is to be a father. I know, I've spent my life running away from what you've got right there in your arms." The baby poked his father again and said, "Daddy!" The young father studied his boy for a moment, then gave him a friendly bounce in his arm. "Yeah, that's my boy," he said. Then he sniffed the diaper again. "I guess I better go change this thing." "Yeah, well, I think you might want to change something else while you're at it." "What's that?" he said. "Your attitude." "Yeah, it kind of stinks, don't it?" "Yeah, but I think it's going to be okay." One of the most intriguing aspects of traveling the Alcan is the people you meet. Since there are a few places to go other than up or down the highway, and since most people drive about the same distance each day, a traveler tends to bump into the same folks over and again. So a certain camaraderie develops, because everyone has one thing in common, the road. I visited with sophisticated scholars, hunter-survivalists, tie-dyed granola bars, oil field hands, construction workers, and well-heeled retirees, and a few folks much like myself. For the most part, everyone was friendly and took time to visit. One morning, I took a break to sit in the Laird Hot Springs. This detour is an absolute must for anyone who wants to soak away the aches and pains of the highway. The springs are located in the Muncho Lake Provincial Park, about 100 miles from the Yukon Territory. A hike down a boardwalk that snaked its way across a steaming swamp. The walkway was only inches above the surface, so I could easily put my hands or feet in the water, or just sit and study the aquatic life. Signs were posted along the way that described the landscape and stimulated my imagination with images of the predatory dinosaurs that once roamed the swamp. But the most prominent signs warned visitors of the very real and present dangers. Bears. There was a woman who had recently been mauled by a bear near the parking lot. Fortunate for the woman, a man came up on the attack, ran back to his pickup, grabbed his rifle, and shot the bear. It was unfortunate for the man, however, because he was an American hunter who was on his way down from Alaska, and he didn't have proper authority to be carrying a loaded gun in Canada. Therefore, he was promptly thrown in jail. I hiked up to the Hanging Lake, which was fed by steaming hot spring water. Therefore, the pond was surrounded by ferns and tropical plants that you'd expect to see closer to the equator. I had to remind myself I was in the Rocky Mountains and was nearer to the Arctic Circle than the equator. The plant life seemed out of place, to say the least, and I wondered how it came to be here. Certainly no one had brought the vegetation 5,000 miles north. The life forms had obviously evolved to suit their environment. Imagine that. The steaming water that bubbled to the surface at the springhead was hotter than a cup of McDonald's coffee. I eased in up to my thighs and immediately eased back out. My legs turned bright pink and looked like a freshly boiled lobster. The hot water cascaded from one pool to the next until it reached a stream of cooler water. I worked my way down the pools, testing each one like Goldilocks, sampling each pot, trying to find the one that was just right. Of course, when I did find the one that was just right, I also found several other people, simmering up to their necks in the human stew. Some of their faces were familiar, having seen them on the road over the last few days. They were engaged in lively conversations about money, power, sex, rock and roll, the meaning of life, and, of course, the road. No matter what their livelihood or political views were, there was one thing for certain. Everyone was benefiting from the existence of the road. One of the couples I met were country folk rock singers who made their living as traveling minstrels. The old hippies had been on the road since the 1970s, and we had plenty to talk about, especially after they learned I was traveling in a homemade camper. Although they had spent 15 years traveling in a converted school bus, now they were enjoying the comforts of a late model motorhome. When I met them, they were headed south, with the hopes of going all the way to South America. I told the old hippies about a book I had called Road Fever by Tim Cahill. Cahill and his partner drove a GMC pickup truck from Tierra del Fuego, Argentina to Prudhoe Bay. The book described their adventure in great detail, shedding many insights about the hazards of driving through South and Central America, not the least of which was contracting a major dose of road fever. After observing bizarre changes in their personalities, Tim Cahill coined the term road fever. The old hippies and I walked out to the parking lot and spent another hour trading stories about homemade motorhomes. Although they enjoyed their factory-built camper, they waxed nostalgically about traveling in their old school bus. Before we went our separate ways, we traded demo tapes, and I gave them my copy of Road Fever. As I was leaving the parking area, I felt someone staring at me. Across the way stood a middle-aged woman with long dark hair that was turning gray on top and parted down the middle. Her t-shirt was tie-dyed, her skirt was hand-woven, and she was wearing Birkenstock sandals with wool socks. She was standing beside an old school bus that had been converted into a camper. Her male companion was sitting in the driver's seat, gunning the engine and creating an oily cloud of blue smoke. The original steel body of the bus had been removed and replaced with an enormous wooden structure. There was a chimney from a wood cook stove protruding from the side, and the camper was towing an old pickup truck outfitted with a wooden flatbed, which was stacked high with firewood. As I idled past the woman, it was clear she was not smiling at me. I raised my hand in a friendly gesture and said hello. She didn't acknowledge my greeting. She just stood there with her arms crossed, staring at me with a look of hatred and contempt. That's when I noticed several politically correct bumper stickers on the rear of the pickup. One of them said, "Honor Diversity." It was right next to the one that said, "Save the Forest." Another one said, "Visualize World Peace." Well, I'm about as diverse a sumbitch as there ever was, and she didn't seem to be honoring me. And judging from the wooden camper, the wood cook stove, the wooden flatbed, and the stack of firewood, I'd guess the tree huggers had just clear-cut a friggin' forest. Furthermore, I don't know about you, but for me, it's kind of difficult to visualize world peace when the promoters of the idea seem to despise other people based on what they drive. Hello, is anybody out there? Attention, travelers. Control freaks are often disguised as harmless hippies. Please use caution when approaching. Thank you. The next morning, I was eating breakfast at a small cafe when an older gentleman, dressed in expensive casual clothes, spun around and barked at me. Are you driving that black thing out there? He asked. Yes, sir. What the hell is it? It's a combination motorhome, studio, and Harley hauler. Looks like a damn waste of money to me. I glanced out the window and recognized a diesel pickup with a fifth-wheel camper, which I had passed several times during the last week. The elaborate combination was the most expensive money could buy. Didn't I pass you the other day on Steamboat Mountain? I asked. Yeah, and you were driving like a damn maniac. I remembered seeing the pickup, struggling to pull the camper up the long grade, and Zelda sailed by without even breaking a sweat. I pride myself in being a safe and considerate driver, and I doubted that my driving was the real issue here. I did, however, suspect that I blew the doors in on the old man's ego. Attention, travelers. Control freaks are often disguised as harmless retirees. Please use caution when passing. Thank you. That afternoon, I made it as far as Watson Lake in the Yukon Territory. The most noticeable thing about Watson Lake is the signpost forest. Many years ago, someone put up a sign with arrows pointed in various directions stating, Fairbanks, 1,120 miles, Miami, 3,630 miles, Tokyo, 4,620 miles. Then along came another traveler who posted the mileage to his own hometown. Then came another and another and another. Now there are virtually hundreds of signposts and thousands of signs. The signs varied in size, shape, style, and composition. Some were artistic and well thought out. Others were ugly and crudely fashioned. There were street signs, city limit signs, door signs, family crest signs, and signs made out of broken auto parts, license plates, and hubcaps. You name it, there's a sign. There was a sign from Lippe-Detmold, West Germany, 9,450 kilometers. Other signs read Nebraska, the Good Life, and Johnny and Elvis, Brooklyn, New York. And there was a sign that said, Don't mess with Texas. One sign was from Crumacucci, Florida, which was the same Crumacucci where I spent my youthful summers straddling a dirt bike. Several signs were from Key West, which was evidence that I sure as hell wasn't the first fool to drive all the way from there. I decided to put up my own sign, so I dug out the signboard I'd used at the Songwriter Showcase in Nashville. It was a color enlargement of my demo tape and had the silhouette of a truck on it. Born with Wheels was scrolled across the bottom, so I took a marker and wrote across the top, On the Wrong Road to Nashville in Zelda the Pete. I posted my sign and was about to leave when I noticed a new four-door diesel pickup parked next to Zelda. It was a nice truck and was pulling a large enclosed trailer that was painted to match. I'd seen it several times over the last week and was wondering what he was hauling. The owner was digging around in the back of the truck as though he were looking for something. How you doing? I asked. Oh, I'm okay if I could just figure out what to do about a sign. Kids want to put up a sign. He was grumbling, although he didn't seem aggravated. A young boy and girl were running around the truck screaming while the mother was impatiently throwing together some sandwiches on the tailgate. I got a piece of wood. I just don't know how to paint. Maybe I can help. I've done some lettering before. Oh, yeah? He eagerly pushed the materials toward me. The brush he had was for painting houses, not lettering signs, but it's all he had. I took the brush and dipped the corner into a can of bright red paint. What do you want it to say? Oh, I don't care. Just put our names on it. Is that what you want, Meg? He didn't wait for the answer he seemed to know he wouldn't get. That's all. Just put our names on it. Okay. And what are they? Oh, yeah. Let's see. Dan and Meg, and there's Ray and Sue. Sue's the little one. He pointed to the little girl who was running from her brother and screaming at the top of her lungs. Is that okay, Meg? Is that what you want? Still no answer. Yeah, that's great. Just put Dan and Meg and Ray and Sue. They seemed to like three letters names, which was good, because the piece of wood was only so big. Oh, yeah, don't forget the name of our town. You want that on there, Meg? Still no answer. The kids are getting on her nerves, Dan confided to me, but she overheard him and gave him a dirty look. It's probably just a dose of road fever, I confirmed. Yeah, I don't think she likes that road very much. Meg gave him another dirty look. I looked at the sign that was covered in clumsy red letters. I could have done better with a lettering brush, but this'll have to do. Hey, it's great, ain't it, Meg? Still no answer. So what's the name of your hometown? Kleinfeltersville, Pennsylvania. Holy smokes, the name sounds bigger than the town. Well, it is. The biggest thing in town is the city limit sign. I squeezed the 29 letters into the tiny space as best I could, making the sign look even more amateurish. Then I held it up and said, here's your sign. Meg didn't seem to care, and the kids didn't slow down long enough to look. Dan noticed me watching the kids as they ripped and tore about and said, school wanted to put them on Ritalin. Nowadays, all they want to do is drug them up. I told them to go to hell. You ain't putting my kids on drugs. First, they tell everybody to keep the kids off drugs. Then the damn school wants to put them on drugs. I dug a hammer and nail out of Zelda while Dan talked nonstop. We're moving to Alaska. I'm sick of the politicians down in the States. Politicians screwed everything up. You put a politician in charge of the Sahara Desert, next thing you know, you're running out of sand. Politicians screwed up the whole damn country. That's why we're moving up here. I nodded in agreement as Dan continued. Don't get me wrong. I'm no anarchist. I ain't no militia. I just want to be left alone. And I want my kids to be left alone, too. I don't need any politician telling me how to raise my kids. I ain't no survivalist, but I'm learning how to live on my own. I'm learning new things all the time. I learned that you can buy old dairy cows and butcher them up just like beef cattle. Then you pressure cook the meat and can it, just like vegetables. You put in all kinds of spices and cook it down. Tastes good, and it's cheap. Kind of sounds like milk cow stew. Yeah, by golly, that's what it is. It's milk cow stew. Yep, that's what it is. Dan told me about taking early retirement from his sales job. Then he told me what a good deal he got on his new pickup and trailer and how much money he had saved on taxes by moving to Alaska. He didn't seem radical. He didn't seem angry, didn't want revenge, and didn't want somebody else to be responsible for his happiness. He just wanted to be left alone. I thought he had a lot in common with the early day pioneers that made their way west looking for a new start. I liked Dan, even though he talked till my ears bled. We found a good spot to hang their sign, and everyone seemed to approve, although Meg never did quite voice an opinion. When we got back to the pickup, Dan thanked me and gave me a mason jar filled with milk cow stew. I thanked him for the stew and gave him one of my demo tapes. He thanked me for the tape and gave me a new set of screwdrivers. I refused them at first, but he insisted, saying that he'd been a tool salesman and had plenty of leftover samples. So I thanked him for the screwdrivers and dug out a Born with Wheels cap. He thanked me for the cap and handed me three more jars of milk cow stew. I had to put a halt to the trading before he ended up with Zelda, and I ended up with a pickup truck, two hyperactive kids, and an angry wife. One of the truckers who sat in on the all-night jam session back in Calgary had strongly recommended that I stop at a place called Carcross in the Yukon Territory and look up a fiddle player by the name of Rusty May. I found Carcross on the map and decided to try a shortcut through the muskeg. Muskeg is a spongy, partially decayed layer of vegetation that's abundant in the northwest, and it's a pretty good indicator that the ground beneath is unstable. I questioned the logic of driving a 43-year-old truck down an unmarked dirt road surrounded by muskeg in the middle of the Yukon Territory. And I'm certain that was on the list of stupid things a guy can do. But hey, it was a shortcut. I crept across the path for nearly an hour until I came to another paved road, and shortly thereafter, I was pulling into Carcross. During the Gold Rush days, the village had been a busy seaport connected to the Pacific Ocean via rivers and lakes. A set of railroad tracks led down to the water where they merged with a wooden boat dock, but there were no signs of any trains or boats. Now the town relies on tourism for survival, and this was the beginning of the off-season. The only sign of life was at the old train station, which had been converted into a travel information bureau and museum. I went inside, browsed through the display of black and white photographs, and stopped at the information booth. Have you ever heard of a fiddle player named Ruby? No, I never heard of her, the lady said. He means Rusty May, a girl interrupted. That's not right, the lady retorted. Sure it is. He's looking for Rusty May. She's that fiddle player up in Whitehorse. I doubt that's who he's looking for. The woman mumbled as she thumbed through some papers without looking at me or the girl. That's when I noticed the resemblance between the two. I was stuck in the middle of a mother-daughter power trip.
Actually, that name does sound right. How can I find her?
She's up in Whitehorse, the girl said. It's Saturday night. She'll be playing somewhere.
The woman glared at me, then glared at the girl. I wasn't in the mood for her pettiness. All I wanted to do was find the damn fiddle player.
Attention, travelers. Control freaks are often disguised as harmless information booth attendants. Please use caution when questioning. Thank you.
I'd driven a good distance out of the way for nothing. I didn't mind the drive so much as I minded wasting fuel. I pulled into Whitehorse just before dark and found a small campground. The campground amounted to a gravel parking lot with plug-ins. No one was around, but a sign said I could help myself to a spot, then pay in the morning. I hooked up Zelda's power line and immediately blew a breaker. I tried another box, and it blew as well, but the third box stayed on. I was desperate for a hot shower, so I headed over to the bathhouse and tested the water. Unfortunately, a midnight dip in the river would have been warmer. I was about to say to hell with Whitehorse and this fiddle player named Rusty May, but then decided to tough it out. She was supposed to be one hell of a fiddle player. I braced myself, stuck my head under the cold shower, and washed away the grease slick from my hair. Then I took a cold sponge bath in the sink. After my heart rate settled down, I went back to Zelda and heated up some milk cow stew, poured it over a bed of crushed Doritos, and smothered it with paste picante sauce. Oh well, at least I had a clean face and a full belly. The sun dropped out of the sky like a rock, and the temperature fell with it. I bundled up in some heavy clothes and walked into town. Besides being the capital city of the Yukon Territory, Whitehorse was also a college town and much bigger than I expected. The streets were filled with people despite the cold temperatures, and I asked someone about the elusive Rusty May and learned that she was playing at a place called Rumors, but no one seemed to know exactly where that was. I asked 10 different people and got 10 different answers. And women wonder why men don't bother asking for directions. After walking every grid in town, I asked some college kids for directions, and they pointed behind me to a small green arrow, which pointed down a stairway to a basement door that said Rumors. It was a typical college bar that could have been any place in the U.S. A mediocre house band was playing with the speed, volume, and precision of a plane crash, and the place was rocking. Of course, everyone was so well lubricated, they would have been rocking and rolling to the rhythm of a grandfather clock. All I was getting out of the so-called music was a headache. Where was this damn fiddle player? I had 6 hours, a couple hundred miles, a cold shower, and now I had a headache invested in this fiddle player. So where the hell was she? I nursed a bud and made myself dizzy while staring at the cigarette smoke swirling about my head. I was beginning to think this was another one of my crazy dreams when an attractive young woman with long waves of auburn hair stepped up to the microphone and simply said, "Hello." She was rather small and built solid like an athlete. Her eyes sparkled through the smoky haze and her broad smile beamed in the spotlight. The backup band only consisted of one acoustic guitar player, but when Rusty May propped that fiddle on her shoulder and drew the bow across the strings, sound filled the room like a symphonic orchestra. While the fingers of her left hand danced across the neck of the fiddle, her right hand drew the bow across the strings like tiny bolts of lightning. The muscles in her thighs flexed and tremored, and sparks seemed to fly as her high-heeled red cowboy boots hammered out a rhythm on the old wooden floor. Bluish-white stage lights created a halo around her locks of unruly red hair as beads of sweat collected on her forehead, reflecting the neon rainbow. She was hot. Red hot. And the place was smoking. I thought they'd have to call 911. Rusty sawed off dozens of familiar jigs before really setting the house on fire with a marathon rendition of Cotton Eye Joe. Swarms of people joined together on the dance floor, linking themselves arm in arm, engaged in a dance that swirled in a constant state of change, yet always connected. Throughout the lively song, she blended in a medley of tunes like Mary Had a Little Lamb, Yankee Doodle Dandy, Jesus Loves Me, and even the 1812 Overture. It was like some sort of crazy symphony where everyone was playing a different melody, yet they were all interwoven and dependent on each other, much like the dancers on the floor and the travelers on the road. Rumors turned out not to be a rumor, and Rusty May was more than a dream, because her music resonated with life. When she was finished, I raced out into the cold night air to savor the glorious echoes in my mind, before the profane sounds of mere mortals could pollute nirvana.
The drive to Fairbanks was uneventful, although scenic. Muskeg lined the highway on both sides, while the ever-present mountains stood guard in the background. My eyes vegged out on the scenery while I daydreamed and munched on some road candy. During long stretches of tiresome driving, I liked to exercise my mind by poring over the details of various ideas. I sometimes call these ideas road candy, because I'll pop a handful in my head and munch on them for hours on end. That day, I completely dismantled Zelda in my mind and built a lean, mean Alcan driving machine, complete with a cantilevered air ride front axle and the entire camper riding on airbags. When I was finished with that project, I swallowed that road candy and popped in some more. This time, I organized a road rally for trucks. It'd be similar to a car rally, with the exception of using old trucks like Zelda. Drivers would earn points for operating safely, filling out accurate logs, and picking up small parcels of freight at hard-to-find, out-of-the-way places. The drivers would have no idea what their route would be until they received their so-called dispatch. Sponsors could advertise on the trucks, and the event would be called the Great Freight Race. Road candy can be an excellent antidote for road fever. I was wasted by the time I reached Fairbanks. I was tired of munching on road candy, tired of thinking about building trucks, tired of organizing road rallies in my mind, and to be perfectly honest, I was getting sick and tired of this road trip. All I really wanted was a hot bath and a soft, warm bed. The first campground I came to was a place called Santa Land. It was located, wouldn't you know, at the North Pole. There was a 30-foot-tall fiberglass Santa standing out front, and all the parking lanes had reindeer names. It wasn't the macho kind of place one might expect to find on the edge of the wilderness, but I ignored my protesting testosterone and wheeled Zelda into the drive. As it turned out, Santa Land was the best campground I'd stopped at all summer. It was clean, the people were nice, the showers were scalding hot, and the electrical hookups actually worked. I was so comfortable that I decided to stick around for a few days to rest up and catch up on some riding. And, actually, I think Zelda kind of likes sharing accommodations with Dasher and Dancer and Donner and Blitzen.
Please fast forward to side B.